Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, wrestling friends. I'm Matt Kuhn, and this is the Gentleman Villain Podcast with the Lordship himself, the head of the Blackpool Combat Club, Mr. William Regal. How are you doing today, Mr. Regal?
Wonderful, Matt. How are you? Well, saying I'm wonderful. Over my wife, it's in a couple of days, it's my 36th anniversary.
Wow.
Since I got married. Over my wife on the phone with my mother-in-law today. She's not doing so well. She had to go to the doctor's the other day. The doctor said, strip off. She's got a bit of lettuce sticking out the top of her underwear, my mother-in-law. The doctor said, that looks nasty. She said, oof, that's nothing. It's just the tip of the iceberg. There we go. So, right, we're off to a good one. Here we go.
That is a good one.
All these old jokes are not mine. I've stolen them off other old British comics, but for the 26 people that listen to this podcast, 25 of them have never heard them before. So there we go.
The 25 are having a good time. And I'm telling you what, many, many, many more than 25 listened to our podcast a couple weeks ago. Of course, it's the first time we're taping since we did the episode on MJF.
And
a lot of reaction to the MJF. I got a little reaction I might not have wanted to get. But, you know, maybe got a phone call or two I didn't want to get. But there was
phone call
a lot.
Or two. See, nobody ever says anything to me.
Yeah, people are afraid of you. the listeners and actually all those news sites that you hold so dear to yourself, they all loved that episode. They loved seeing the reality of how you felt about it, the passion that you talked about it, and really just the entire story of the MJF William Regal relationship. Were you surprised by the reaction to it? Did you see the reaction to it?
No, of course I didn't. No,
but it wasn't a hard show for you to do.
That's why it's me, because it's if you start it, that might lead to a lot of things today. But if you start buying into your own nonsense, it can be a slippery slope. If you start, you know, we've talked about this on this podcast before. I've always had an incredible support system in this job from really talented people who were far better than me from being a very young age. So they're the people I listen to. Too many voices. And you can't, if you don't know or don't have that support system, or you've got to look to the world to see what's going on about yourself. I don't need to. There's always somebody who I think knows better than me or is better than me who will tell me if I'm doing something right or wrong. And so I keep that, because too many voices in any line of work or any, I see it in wrestling, too many opinions, it just messes with your head. And when you need to be concentrating on getting good at yourself and getting good at your job or doing the training you're supposed to be doing or worrying about what somebody you've never met thinks about you. It's just stuff that I, from a young age, have been fortunate enough not to have affect me. So I don't expect, it's very easy for me to say that when we've said this before. I'm not envious of anybody. I'm not jealous of anybody. I do my job and I've been fortunate to be born in the right time where I had great people, the best possible wrestlers in Britain, then in Europe, then and different parts of the world, and then come to America and have the best wrestlers from then on that were in WCW when I first got here, and me knowing that they were the real deal and them giving me advice. And so I keep all that stuff out because otherwise it's just going to mess with my head or get, you know, if sometimes I hear things or somebody tell, you know, because you've got, you know, how it is, people always want to tell you stuff. Somebody starts telling me something that somebody said something about me, then if it's about the character or about William Regal, I don't care. If it's something personally about me, then I might find out about it and then somebody might be getting a call.
Yeah.
Because you don't know, very few people know me. The character, I embellish whatever it is, right? Where we've, you know, and part of the MJF thing and part of the Chris Jericho stuff, you know, talking about stuff that I've done. It's been 20 odd years ago and it was a short period of my life when I was doing certain things. But it's just become part of the character that I'm this old, whatever I am, right? This sure. old rogue. But if I find out, and I can only think of twice in my life when I've actually done that. And that was once somebody had mentioned, somebody had said something about me being backstage. And I was like, whoa, you don't know anything about me. We've never met. So I got hold of him. I said, look, you say anything you want about my wrestling. I couldn't care less because I'm not going to read it. Don't ever mention my personal, the way I conduct myself personally. One, you don't know. Two, it's just secondhand gossip from people who shouldn't be gossiping or jealous people or envious people. And then another thing was because when I got hold of somebody, well, through WWE, I got hold of somebody because it was, I don't need to go into detail, but a very, very serious, you know, a horrendous incident that people were saying I because I lived in the same area as somebody that I knew more than was going on. And I had no clue. We've talked about that story on this.
Yep.
We've gone through all that. That's it. That's my part of that world. The only time I ever get any, there's one person who gets hold of me and somehow, and that was through somebody else or something. And I get the odd message. Is it okay if I talk to you? Yep. What's it about? And it's always, unfortunately, it's to me, it's the Grim Reaper getting hold of me. It's about a dead English wrestler.
Right.
And did I know him? And if I've got anything good to say, I'll say it, and otherwise never. Because you can put a blowtorch to my face. I am never going to spill any backstage gossip. I'm never going to do, it's just not my world. I don't like, I come from a, not only the wrestling world, but the people I used to hang around with in clubs and stuff. It's not the thing to be doing. So we're off that subject.
Absolutely.
But I get other people having to do that because people want praise and people want that. We've talked about this before. I come from a time when it was just sit down, shut up, do your job, and then if you don't get told off, you're doing okay. And it's a different world now. Everybody's from day one. If in the last 30 years, you know, if you get into this job, you're reading about yourself. And if you don't have that structure that I had, which is, again, very fortunate for me, of great talent from being very, very young, from being 17, or, well, you know, even before that. But at 17, I had Britain's best wrestler guiding, telling me what was right and wrong about my wrestling. From 18, I had Fit Finlay and Rollerball Rocco and Pete Robertson, Terry Rudge and Dave Taylor. And I don't need anybody else telling me.
Well, absolutely.
And then Arn and Rick and Bobby Eaton and Paul Orndorff and, you know, and Ricky Steamboat. And why do I need anybody else telling me what I need?
And speaking of those people, and speaking of listening to people, you know,
that's why it's going to tie people, into this.
Yeah. We listen to people on Twitter and we put it out on our Twitter for the Gentleman Villain podcast.
Glass jar again.
Glass jar, if Brian Danielson hears. There's no plastic being used
please.
At
no
all.
No plastic, Brian. Yeah.
And we put it out on our Twitter. We put out a poll. We're going to do it every couple of weeks. We're going to put out a poll as to what topics you want to hear about. And the topic we heard about today had to do with some other guys that you respect and put, you know, kind of put you under your wing. And that has to do with you becoming television champion in 1993 in WCW. You had a good run as WCW television champion.
Four times. So, and unbelievable. Unbelievable at 25 that I got that opportunity. I mean, really unbelievable. Yeah.
What was the role that you saw as the television champion? Like, what you know, in WWE, WWF, it's always been considered, you know, that the Intercontinental title is the working man's title. I always felt that
that's what
the role WCW of the TV title.
TV title, yes. And if you look at the people who, the majority of people who had it, it was the people who could go out and put the time in and with anybody. And that was, occasionally it got switched to other people, but if you look at the majority of people, it was the Arn Andersons, the Tully Blanchards, the Steve Austins, the Bobby Eatons, the people that could be relied on, proper pros who can do proper pro wrestling.
We're going to get into, you know, of course, you winning the title for the first time from Mr. Steamboat. But you mentioned Tully Blanchard, who's someone you didn't cross paths with before, probably AEW.
No.
Were you watching Crockett before you came to the States?
So the first American wrestling that I saw, I'd already nearly been wrestling 2 years. Because we had our own wrestling in Britain, you know, we you couldn't, and there was no, it's hard now, right? If I say this, it's not in anybody's brain that you can't just watch wrestling all the time. I watched wrestling at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, or I went to live shows when I was a child, and that was it. There was nothing in like exposing wrestling. You knew what you saw. And you heard whatever you saw from the commentary, Kent Walton was the commentator. So I knew about wrestlers from other countries. Sometimes they get a mention in different things. But it wasn't really... and then I started getting in the early 80s, occasionally in the local town, which is now considered a city in Britain. You have to have a population of over 1 million to be considered a city. So the local town to me, was 7 miles away, occasionally in a newsstand, as you call it, news agents, as we call it in Britain, I saw, it was like 1981 maybe, a Rings Wrestling magazine, as what is known as the Apter, Bill Apter, good friend of mine, Bill's Apter's magazines, right? Oh, I couldn't believe it. I like, what's this? What is this world now? I've heard, you know, obviously know there's wrestling in America and that, but didn't know anything about it. So with that, you used to get all about the territories and all the stories. And so I had I mean, when I say very rare, every few months there would be one turn up. And I used to ask this one lady that worked there, any of these that turn up, can you keep one for me? And then there'd be the Wrestler magazine and stuff. So that was before I got into the wrestling. That was my sort of introduction to more than just British wrestling, because there was different stories about different people, and it was all fascinating because there was all these incredible photographs and, you know, Judge Napolitano and
right, all Bill the results all from all the territories and all the
fantastic.
I loved it. I lived in
to
that.
To a wrestling fan, I mean, I, you know, me wanting to be a wrestler from being a youngest, it was like dream stuff. I devour these magazines when I could get them, which was very rare. So eventually, I get into the wrestling. We've gone through all that. friend of mine, we mentioned him before, Peter Thompson, was also in the wrestling. He got the first tapes that I saw, which were would have been in 95. Sorry, 85, 1985. So I'd had my first match in 1983. I didn't start as a full-time pro until, which when I say full-time pro, I was barely eking a living, but I was still a full-time pro from July of 1984. I was 16. So he got some tapes, and the first tapes that he actually got were NWA from Charlotte. So it was like, wow. You know, I really, there were certain things that, that's very different the way we did stuff because it wasn't the same rule system. You know, we've talked about that, I think, before. British wrestling on, that was on TV and the wrestling that we saw was all in rounds and there was the Lord Mount Evans rules of wrestling.
And the NWA things. At that time was so focused on promos. And yes, you said
and that was
there
it.
Wasn't
didn't
a lot
see
of promos.
Anything.
Yeah,
and yeah, he didn't see any promos.
That must have been
an
eye-opener for you to see
a
these
big
guys.
Eye-opener.
Like, Tully might come out two or three times a show,
right,
you know,
yeah.
just to talk, or Ric Flair. That must have been something for you to see a whole different side of what wrestling could be.
A whole different side, and wow, just you know, we've talked about this before, there's a lot of styles in Britain. People think there's a British style. There's lots of different styles and things sort of melted together a lot more in the 80s. But, you know, and every weight class, there was weight classes, lightweight, middleweight, heavy middleweight, light heavyweight, heavy middleweight, heavyweight. I think I've got that in the right order. And everyone had a British champion, a European champion and a world champion. Some reason the middleweight champion of the world never showed up in Britain. You know, looking back now, but
right,
didn't know. You know, like the lightweight champion was Johnny Saint was the man in for 20 years, and before him there was the legendary George Kidd, and there was all kinds of fascinating characters in Britain. But there was when I watched NWA from. You know, and then there was like these great middleweight wrestlers. We've talked about the what is like the mid heavyweight and junior heavyweight, but we've talked about all that before. And heavyweight, the really good heavyweights were only about very rarely because a lot of them went abroad. They made more money in Germany and Japan and Africa, which is what I fortunately got to do from 20 to 24. And then I came to America. So I traveled the world. So seeing NWA, it was a lot bigger fellas, but going at it, you know, like there was a heavyweight style, which was put on mostly the good heavyweights in Britain were put on. If you watch any of the stuff, a lot of it isn't, it's very credible looking, solid looking wrestling, which is a lot of what I did. Even though I was a character when I came to America, once I started doing so, is forearm and forearm smashing and putting holds on and people before me had done that in America. Obviously legendary Billy Robinson and Tony Charles and Les Norton and people and Adrian Street did a lot of that style, but was more flamboyant. But it was put on specifically to give wrestling in Britain that style was not so much a lot of villainy and baby faces. It was more of two heavyweights to go on so that they could say people couldn't knock the style. If that makes any sense, the promoters sure. wanted the heavyweights to do a certain style and more just
credible,
competitive, credible style to give the job credibility.
Right.
So to see the NWA and watching these big fellas moving about and watching Manny Fernandez, one of the first things I saw was him doing like jumping on the ropes from in the middle rope and doing a flying back. And I'm like, whoa, this is different. In fact, little story to add to this. We saw that. We went to a show that day or the next day, and my friend Peter, who got the tape, the rings in, we used to have to We used to do all these loads of little shows in Britain.
Did he try a flying forearm off the ropes?
What we did? We put the ring up because there was no people in this building. We put the ring up, and it was a 14-foot ring, and the promoter we worked for, Bobby Barron, he was like a second dad to me. I wouldn't be in this job without him, nor would Robbie Brookside and a lot of people in Britain. It was one of the few guys that would give people a chance, I've talked about him before, so I don't need to talk about him, but he was known for having really bad rings, right? In fact, his nickname was Dodgy. Dodgy in England means something that's suspect, a bit not right. And they used to call him Dodgy Bob. And it wasn't because he was a dodgy promoter. He was always he's always looked after everybody as far as money. It was because his rings were dodgy. They were all suspect. In fact, I'm going off on these tales. So unfortunately, in 1994, he passed away. And I got the news. I was in America and I got the news. I flew back for his funeral. And I'm there. There's loads of wrestlers there. Dave Taylor, I hadn't seen for a year or so because he hadn't moved to America yet. Dave was there with Dave's brother Steve, with Dave's dad Eric Taylor, who was an incredible wrestler in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. There were loads of wrestlers there, and there's all the flowers outside the ring, Bobby. Bobby Barron's best friend was a fellow called Jack, and he'd had this ring made out of flowers, and it was like a wrestling ring, and it had beautiful, he used to wrestle as beautiful Bobby Barron, all in lovely flowers, and we just all stood there looking at the flowers, and I'm stood next to Dave Taylor, and Steve is Dave's brother, and Steve just went, "That's the best ring he's ever had," and we just start laughing. So, back to this, we watch this NWA, and I see Manny Fernandez. We're watching all kinds of stuff, but Manny Fernandez jumping on the middle rope in the middle of the ring. We put the ring up the next day. There's nobody there. Peter just goes, runs, jumps onto the middle rope, and obviously the ropes were crap, you know. Right. He just broke straight and off, and he went straight through and landed on the floor and like creamed himself. He was all lying on the floor. So we figured out you couldn't really do the stuff. They had these really good rings and we didn't, you know. So that was how it sort of started, me watching Tully, you know, on the Four Horsemen, Dusty, everybody. So that was my introduction to whoever was the TV champion at the time. And we were getting those pretty regularly after that. And Peter was. And so he'd lend them me and I'd watch them whenever we had time because didn't have a lot of time because we were working all the time. Right. So it was watching. That was sort of our start of watching American wrestling was the NWA.
And the reason I bring that up is because we talked about, we mentioned briefly that in that NWA era, you didn't really see competitive matches except that TV title. You would see a Manny Fernandez face a Tully Blanchard. You would see a Buddy Landell face, a Dusty Rhodes who had the TV title for a bit. But fast forward to when you get to WCW in 93, it doesn't take you long. You know, you get there, in early 93, I think, right? And
I came on. I started on my first day was the 25th of January, 1993, which is going to be nearly 30 years soon, isn't it?
My goodness. And it fast forward a few months to the fall, to the first fall brawl ever.
Yes.
And you find yourself competing for the TV title.
Oh.
And there's a lot going on in WCW. There's a lot at the time,
There's a lot
going on.
You've got
Bill Watts coming in and out. You've got
Bill Watts brought me here, and then he goes after 3 months. So I'm thinking, well, I'm gone. This is before I became Lord Steven. I'm thinking I'm going. So anyway, it all worked out. I became Lord Steven, and for whatever reason, somebody like me, and I know Ole had a lot to do with that, and I know Greg Gagne and Mike Graham and Dusty, and they were people that were in the office at the time. They took a liking to me, Barry Windham. So I'm stood across the ring in Houston with Michael Buffer, who was as over as could possibly be at the time.
As soon as I saw him,
unbelievable, right? I'm Ricky Steamboat, a man, and I think we've talked about this. I used to watch Ricky Steamboat's matches with Ric Flair, that series from 1989, where I would do squats to that series of matches. I would do them and do my Hindu squats to them, thinking if I can keep up with him, I can keep up with anybody, because the pace they were going. I would do sometimes, you know, over 1,000 squats or whatever it was. If that 1 hour match, I would base it like do squats for the whole match. Then they had like the 30 minutes. So whatever amount of matches, there was a three or four of them in that particular series. I got those on tape, and for whenever I was in England, I would put them on. That was my sort of, okay, this keeps me in rhythm. And sometimes I'd speed it up, so I'd do them faster on the shorter matches. On the hour match, I would take my time a bit. It was like I really know a lot about those matches. I've watched them so many times, and that was over the next couple of years. Whenever I was back in England, that was my thing. If I was at home, I'd get up in the morning and I would put that tape on and I would do my squats to it, to watching their matches, right? That was before I went to the gym, before I did anything else. I'd do my conditioning training was Hindu squats. And so this is Ricky Steamboat now. I'm stood, and this all happened so quick, you know. I'm in Germany wrestling in, you know, sometimes in big tents for weeks. I'm in the best place you can be in Europe, but I've come to America. It's all like, pow, and I'm 24. Then I turned 25 in the May of 93. And in September, I'm stood in opposite Ricky Steamboat with Michael Buffer announcing from Blackpool, England. And I'm thinking, I may look calm, cool and collected. I am going, what am I doing here? How has this happened in such a short? Because, you know, like, it's just like, it's really like somebody punching me in the face. Got luckily, I know how to keep my composure. I wanted to just go, oh, what am I doing here? Like, what, you know, and not through thinking I could do it, but like as a fan going, what am I doing in this ring with Ricky Steamboat and Mike? Well, Michael Buffer was just an extra thing, but Ricky Steamboat stood there, and I'm about to face him for the WCW World Television Championship, and knowing since 85 that this was the championship that you had to be able to go, right? And I'm going to add this in now. We've talked about the squat. Like, my hair's still a bit wet. I've just done my squats before we did this. I jumped in the shower before we did this, because I still it was the machines. I always call it, like, you had to be a machine to have any like legs as a television champion, because every show that WCW did, you were doing a match on it. Well, we used to tape like either two or sometimes three tapings in a night. And I was used to doing long matches, but a 10-minute draw, three, and I've done plenty of those in that next, because if you look, it was about an 18-month period. Every single TV show, that's, you know, and at that time, that's why I sort of made my name. Because I was on TV, they gave me that opportunity. I was on TV on every single show, doing a draw.
Right. Yeah.
Doing a draw with somebody, either 10 or 15 minute draw.
Right.
And I think that, you know, let's not kid ourselves. They used to shave the times to suit the TV, whatever, make it sometimes it wasn't quite 15 minutes. It might have been 30.
Turner time.
Yeah. Well, you know, but still doing. And for every Arn Anderson, Terry Taylor, Brad Armstrong, Ricky Steamboat, any of the brilliant wrestlers that I wrestled, and then, and if it was people who weren't on contract, I had such an incredible amount of incredible extra talent with Frankie Lancaster, Mark Starr, Barry Houston, people like that. people that were really good, that a lot of them had trained with Dean Malenko's dad, you know, so they were all really good. I had really good people. But for every one of those that I had a lot of people that weren't. And to get through 10-minute draws or 15-minute draws with some people, when we start, and at the same time as well, in that September, I think it was, was it September or October, whoever, if you look this up, was when we did the first ever Orlando tapings that there were like the worldwide shows, which is because every company since then has done that. But it was the first time we did 4 days and did 13 shows in 4 days. Wow. I had to do 13 or 14 10-minute draws in 4 days, which great, Arn Anderson, great Terry Taylor, great Brad Armstrong.
But
me. And I was a conditioning machine. Believe me, I always might not add be cosmetically in what considered great shape. Then again though, people used to say I didn't have a sort of a great physique. When I go back now and look compared with some wrestlers now,
it's not funny.
It's like I used to, and there's a lot of things we're going to get into now, but I used to be constantly I was always training and the machine, step up, squats, because I knew I had to go, right? There's a lot of my physique had changed from, I think we've talked about that when I was 22. And we're talking about
someone who's 6 foot. Three?
I'm 6 foot three and 240
pounds, 240,
maybe that, or maybe a bit more.
That's a different kind of being in shape. You know, that's a different level than if you're a bit smaller than that.
There's pictures knocking about of me when I had more of a bodybuilder kind of look. Well, when I was 22, I kept that for a while. But once I came to America, especially once I changed to Lord Steven, I realized this and the work rate.
The face, yeah.
It was more, and this match is the match. I don't never complain, but this match against Ricky Steamboat was the night that I broke my neck and never told anybody for 20 years.
Wow. I just watched
the match. And you can see the match. If you look, watch the very end and you will see Ricky Steamboat skin the cat. And I grab him in a German suplex, and I can always soup. I go back, and if you watch, my neck just goes bang. Just,
oh, my
And
goodness.
Both of my arms and both of my legs went lightning bolts down them, and I thought, something's not right here. But I get my hand held up at the end of it.
And, with a belt in the other hand.
And I don't ever tell anybody.
Right.
And that continued until I was 45. And so there was times when my body was shot. But I always kept doing my squats, and I always kept doing. So there was times when I might look a bit better, but there was a while after that I couldn't barely lift my arms up. But I was still wrestling constantly. I never stopped, and I just never told anybody until, when was it, March this year, when I decided to finally tell people.
Right.
But that's the truth. I broke my neck on that match with the first night that I wrestle Ricky Steamboat.
There's so much to unpack there because, you know, you're a young guy, you get this chance, you get the title, your neck breaks, you don't tell anybody.
No.
You're not really, as you drink out of your non-plastic cup, you're not a regret guy. You're not a guy who goes...
Not in the slightest,
but
no.
You are a guy who works with younger people. If you were working with a young person today in that same situation, you would say, what? No, give up the title. Get the surgery, take the rehab.
Whatever.
I guess the lesson you learned was you learned.
Well, I didn't
for other
know
people.
I'd broke my neck.
Right.
I just thought I'd hurt my neck really badly. And
really
knowing,
badly.
It you
really
know,
hurt.
Like I've explained that on Chris Jericho spoke. What happened? For whatever reason, something exploded, and a big lump of like jellyfied calcium stuff kept my neck together for 20 years. So after a while, it went okay. The pain, there was like no pain. It like sort of cut right. off all the nerves and stuff. So it was, although I broke my neck, it got, the only problems I used to get, like my arm was never right again on the left side.
Right.
And I used to get a really lot of spasming on my left side, which still isn't good on my left.
Yeah,
my
that's
left
what trap. I get for my neck surgery is the left right. arm stuff.
The left trap. Yeah. So, but I never thought it was just another day in the wrestling and get on with it.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp Therapy Online. You know, we all wish life came with a user manual, especially in these times. We're still seeing a lot of the after effects from the quarantine and all the things that went into that. Not to mention, life wasn't exactly a bowl of roses before the quarantine. And the transition into getting into therapy can be difficult, but BetterHelp Online Therapy is basically the next best thing to getting a user manual for this crazy thing that we call life. You know, and in life, it's normal to feel stuck. When you feel stuck, therapists are trained to help you figure out the cause of challenging emotions and learn productive coping skills, which makes therapy kind of the closest thing to a guided tour of this complex engine called you. BetterHelp has connected over 3 million people with licensed therapists. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of therapy. They're doing a lot of good work because it's convenient, secure, and accessible anywhere and is 100% online. For myself, therapy has been a great thing. And I've said this before, but I'll say it again because I live inside my own head. I don't talk to people. I don't listen to people. I don't like people, except Mr. Regal. But if I need to bounce some ideas off somebody, I really don't have a lot of people I can do it. But with therapy, it helps you kind of get rid of these crazy notions. If you have like negative self-talk or that kind of thing, just saying them out loud to somebody who tells you, hey, maybe there's a different way to look at it. Therapy can be a very, very beneficial thing. And it's never been easier than with BetterHelp. Everyone deserves to feel their best. BetterHelp makes it easier to get started. As the world's largest therapy service, they've matched millions of people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists, available 100% online. All the benefits of in-person therapy, plus you don't have to park, you know, you don't have to drive, you don't have to talk to some secretary. It's more convenient, more accessible, and more affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. And by the way, if you do try therapy, you know, in any type, you know, if it doesn't work out the first time, you know, it's hard to get, it can be difficult to link up two people. And what BetterHelp does is they make it very easy to switch if you feel the need. It really can't be simpler than doing it with BetterHelp. There's no waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Because, like, it's hard. How do you choose out of a phone book? It's hard. I've done it. You know, with BetterHelp, it's a much easier process. It's literally the best possible evolution of getting therapy and having therapy and getting unstuck, which you can do with BetterHelp. Learn more about BetterHelp and save 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/gentleman. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/gentleman. And we thank them for sponsoring the Gentleman Villain Podcast. When they told you, hey, do you have any recollection of them telling you, hey, you're wrestling for the title, you're getting the title? I know you said titles aren't a big deal for you, but for you, also as a young, respectful young man watching wrestling this fella, Ricky Steamboat, who used to do Hindu squats watching, not to mention this guy was in WrestleMania 1. This guy has been around for a long time.
And
it must have meant the world that this title was bequeathed to you by him.
Absolutely. Unbelievable and couldn't believe it. And on top of that, you know, I think it's universally known. Ricky is an absolute gentleman of the highest order.
Nicest guy possible. Yeah.
So, and from the day I got here, he was one of the people that would always come and say, oh, I like the way you did that. Because I was on TV, you see what you see. We were with Bill Watts when I first got here, had us on a lot of house shows. A lot of live events. Well, Ricky was always on them, on the team that I was on. It was him and Shane Douglas against the Hollywood Blondes, Steve Austin and Brian Pillman. So I was always on those shows, and he would come and say, you might want to change this a little. You know, just things that, and always positive stuff, and always helped me. Because I was, I suppose, because I was quiet and polite, and he could see that I was... a real pro wrestler.
And eager to learn. You were eager to learn. You listened.
But he liked what I did as well. Right. You know, like he liked the stuff that... So I know sometimes it's weird bringing his name up, but a lot of people forget that me and Chris Benoit came here at the same time.
Right.
We both started in January of 93. Right. Well, they didn't know what to do with us, either of us really, because at first, before I became Lord Steven.
Y'all both were very different. Like you said, you said earlier, oh, we had Billy Robson and Les Thornton. I'd been watching wrestling for, 12 years by the time I saw you.
Yeah.
All I knew of Les Thornton was he was the guy who worked underneath matches, you know, on TV against the Bulldogs, people like that. Never saw Billy Robinson. So you were the first of a kind I ever saw. And also Benoit was the first of a kind I ever saw. Kind of a high flyer.
He got a hybrid style.
Yeah, hybrid style,
Canada,
right.
That Canada, Calgary territory was such a hybrid thing. And then the Japanese, and he'd been to Europe. So... there was times when we were put on together, and this is probably I'm never one for talking about me getting compliments, but this is the greatest compliment I ever had. And it's the only time I've ever heard Ricky Steamboat swear.
Oh my. Okay.
In all the times. He'd stood at the curtain and watched a match of me and Chris. This would have been early, maybe February or March of 93. And he walked back in and he went, "You two are some working some bitches."
And you heard that's coming from Ricky
Steamboat. A fella who does, I mean, and some bitches isn't exactly a swear word, but he doesn't say stuff like that. And then he was asking us about how we did, because we did a lot of that wrist lock stuff, which is people do all the time now, but people weren't doing that stuff then. It wasn't... you know, putting a wrist lock on and the escapes from a wrist lock and doing stuff that became more prevalent in 2000. I did it a lot in the early 90s, and then I still did it, but there was maybe it didn't get noticed as much. One of the things of being the TV champion and being on TV all the time, this happened at the end of 94. So I was on TV all the time, and then I'm going around all the buildings all the time. And I'm doing all my stuff that I could, you know, a lot of it was me. I'm the exact opposite of every other supposed technical wrestler in the world. I made my credibility, it was me putting myself in, having people put me in moves and me trying to escape from them and do the occasional escape. And because it was a bit different than anybody else, I became known as a technical wrestler. But if you actually go back and watch, especially in this period,
you're a bit of a brawler.
That was after.
Right.
There was a little bit of brawling, but really it was me just having people put me in a wrist lock, or me start with a wrist lock, and then me escaping from, looking like I'm trying to escape and getting flustered trying to escape from it.
Right, right.
Which was doing like kip-ups and all kinds of reversals, but then ending up back in a wrist lock again.
Right.
Which was most other technical wrestlers do loads of moves to people and do technical. I was doing it in a different way because that was a skill set I'd learned before I came to America from the Pete Robertses and Dave Taylors and Marty Joneses and people that, because that's what you had to do when you went out the country, was make other wrestlers who can't wrestle look like good. They can wrestle.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but I did so much of it. This is like a comedian going on TV every week and telling your best joke.
Yeah.
At the end of 94, because I'd been on so many TV matches doing, and again, when I was on with Arn Anderson, we just reacted to each other. Terry Taylor, same. Brad Armstrong, the same. Ricky Steamboat, the same. Brian Pillman, the same. Whoever it was, it didn't matter. We didn't think about anything. But when I was on with people who couldn't do a lot of bodybuilders that couldn't do, that was my go-to. Sort of me escaping from things and putting myself in and out of holes, right? This is about the most you'll ever get me exposing my tricks. But at the end of 94, I came out at the back in Charlotte. Charlotte at the time was a place where they'd obviously, and it ties into this NWA thing, they'd seen so much incredible wrestling, the fans there. And I would always sign autographs as a villain. I never, because I knew I was confident in myself. As soon as I walked out, the same people I could be signing autographs and being polite to, I would never be over polite. I would just sort of, thank you. And whether some villains wouldn't do that. I was confident that I could get them back like that, which I could.
Isn't that more realistic though, really? Is a guy who is just a heel, a villain in the ring, but outside the ring, you're a bit of a professional, as opposed to a guy who's just being a crazy, terrible person outside of the ring all the time.
I also did it with, I was always dressed in a certain way. Right, and I did it right. with a thing.
But seems more realistic than if you were just walking around with your hand behind your back, yes, ignoring people, you know?
So I came out the back of Charlotte, and there was some fans there, and they asked me for an autograph, and one of them said to me, this is the end of 94, they said, we like you. And basically that's what they said. And I went, do you mind me asking why? And they said, well, we've figured it out. And this is really a lot before overexposure of the wrestling.
No internet, trade. No nothing, right?
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, if you read, you could.
A couple books. But there weren't that many books out then either.
Wasn't that much. So this is, you know, again, from anybody that's young listening to this, they don't understand what that was like at that time. This was all different. You know, there was certain small group of fans that could read certain things, but it wasn't what it was by the time the 2000s came along. So they said, oh, we like you. And I said, do you mind me asking you why? And I think we've explained this before. I've always asked questions because I've learned things. And this was the first real, and this was a punch in the face, like as far as learning something. They went, well, we figured it out. When these fellas, you make everybody look like they can do stuff. And that's, you know, they appreciated that they'd seen so much good wrestling. They understood it. The way, however it was phrased to me, they said, we figured out these fellas can't do anything but clotheslines, but when they wrestle you, they can do all these moves that we never see anybody else do. And it was a big in the face to me. I thought, that's it. I've got to change my style because I've overexposed it on TV.
Right.
So I kept that. Then my stuff changed a lot to a lot more striking and a lot more face pulling and a lot more comedic. It wasn't, there was always that in certain parts of what I did, but I completely tried to leave the intricate wrestling to people who actually knew how to react to it without giving it away, if that makes any sense.
Right. You stopped doing it in a way where...
it was too obvious.
Right, giving it to people.
And why would I know any better? Then I'm 26, 27.
Right, right.
So I'm still trying to figure this out. You know, just because I looked whatever I looked, and I've been wrestling, 11 years then. And everywhere I went, I had to learn something new. So... this is America. I had to learn a completely new way of doing things. And yeah, my stuff fit in and I could fit in with a lot of the people that had come from the 80s and that. But there was a group of 90s wrestlers that were wrestling school wrestlers. And that was no knock on anybody. It was just a different period. They hadn't come through territories where they had to adapt and stay around. They'd been gone to wrestling school and then got hired by companies. And then they either figured it out or they didn't. Right. And then it sort of, that was how it was. There wasn't, you couldn't go to, you know, like if you started in the 80s and like Steve Austin and Brian Pillman were the last of those kind of people that, and you know, there's a few others, but they're the ones that I knew that were, you had to go all these different places and either figure it out or you didn't have a job. And a lot of it was, and I was, at the beginning of that, in 93, I got to WCW and was like, don't need to mention names, but, oh, well, he's an hairdresser and he's a bodybuilder and they've just gone, right, you can be a wrestler.
Right.
And then everybody, and if you go back and look, who are the people that are having to wrestle him? Arn Anderson, Terry Taylor.
Zabisco.
Everybody, and that TV title is a, it actually, if you want to look at it from a very, if you ever want, you know, I know people look at this in all different ways. Go back and look at that and look at the people who held it and look at the the transition into the 90s when you started seeing more wrestling school wrestlers and seeing the people, the arms and the people like that who had to carry these people. That is that's a different topic altogether, but that there was a lot of having to teach people on the, like, okay, put them in and out of positions because there was the arms, Terry Taylor, Bobby Eaton, Steve Austin, because he'd picked it up incredibly quickly in his first few years in the whatever territories he worked in. Brian Pillman had been in Calgary, and anybody who'd been in Calgary else you just wouldn't have had a job there. You wouldn't have lasted there. Right. You had to pick it up. They were actually far better than ever I was at their stage of the game, because it took me a long time to get to it. You know, it wasn't until I was 20, but it took me 4 solid years. And having the best trainers working full time, they picked it up in a year and a half or whatever it was. You know, they picked it up a lot quicker than I ever did. And Chris Benoit did as well. And Two Cold Scorpio. And they picked this job up a lot quicker than I ever did. And were very good by the time I met them in 93. So,
well, you had all those people to wrestle with in 93.
Yeah.
You wrestled Ricky Steamboat. You beat him for the title and broke your neck at Fall Brawl.
Yeah.
You kept wrestling. You didn't stop. You had some house shows. You wrestled Mark Starr, who you mentioned earlier.
Mark was a fantastic wrestler. Yeah,
right.
Fantastic. I'm glad I mentioned. Got to mention those. Mark, Frankie Lancaster, Barry Houston. And I apologize to any of the fellas that I did, but you'll see that I wrestled, if you look at the actual TV matches, I got to wrestle a lot of these fellas all the time. And then, and continued it when I was in tags with Triple H and then tags with Bobby, I still the same group of fellas because they were known for being really good at the job and really good extras. They're unsung heroes of the entire early years of my time in WCW. They all, any of them that I can't remember now, you know, but those three people that I became, you know, close with and friends. And I talked to Barry the other day on the phone. We've stayed friends, but they were fantastic. So they could go on with anybody, but if you put them on with somebody good, they had really good matches. You know, I think I'm forgetting. How can I forget? Because they're so close to me. But I mentioned Brad, but then Steve and Scott,
yeah.
and Brian.
Yeah.
I wrestled Brian.
He was there.
Road Dog. Yeah, he was there before he went to WWE. Mm-hmm. So I had the Armstrong boys to wrestle all the time, and it was all incredible.
I saw footage recently of a picture taken on the beach, WCW at the time, where Brian James, the Road Dog, is holding a boom. He's holding a mic boom in the picture. You know, so those guys are just doing everything behind the scenes, not just wrestling, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I wrestled Brian when he first... I know he'd been wrestling a bit, but he'd just come out the forces, and he, you know, I had at least one or two matches when I was I think I was the TV champion then, and then I wrestled Brad quite a lot, and a lot of live events. I wrestled Scott and Steve all the time, and they were fantastic. So I had that first couple of years. The only thing that messed anything up in WCW for me was me, and that was from 97 through, you know.
That's a lot of us in our 20s, though. It's not just you.
No, like, but, you know, us, like, you know,
for sure.
And we've talked about that before.
For sure.
I had an incredible time in WCW. They were always good to me. I had, whether it be, and even the people that weren't good that I had to wrestle, it learnt me something, because I learned, you'd learn another skill set of how to, I knew a skill set going to different countries before I came to America, but then you add to that skill set and then you add to it so it works on in American system and American TV, and that and the amount of promo time I had as the TV champion, that's what really cemented my sort of standing in the job with everybody that was around at the time. You know, it might not have been the... I wasn't a high-flying guy.
And that's something you very much... You learned that from watching American television more than your experience before, or being part of American television before you came to the U.S. You didn't do a lot of promos, right? You talked about
So this is
a new skill set that
and
you're learning.
That was all down to Mr. Schiavone giving me that. Yeah, we've talked about that before, but giving me the opportunity to go down to the CNN Center on a Wednesday on a day's off and putting a camera there for me, which was one of them great, huge, big cameras in those days, in a little spare room on the side where they, because they were doing all their market-specific promos in another room, and I was just in there on my own, just doing promo after promo after promo. This was when I first got here in the January of 93, and I kept doing it, and then that eventually tied into me doing, when I was still just Steve Regal, doing promos on the Saturday night shows or some shows, little ones. And then once I think it was June when I became Lord Stephen, and then promo after promo. I had nothing but, it blows my mind when I go back and look how much incredible TV time and promo opportunity time that people would literally die for now. I had nothing but that. Because I constantly, WCW give me all that incredible time, TV time.
Yeah, that TV time is gold, and it was gold for you. You know, you did the Mark Starr match. You did some that match is listed in your match listings, but I know you did a lot more.
Those match listings are only going to be many, right? Because there's so many live events.
For sure.
You're not going to have all these little. I doubt very much if there's all those little
spot shows and stuff.
That were, you know, in all over Florida, and like Steve Austin can tell you that the same, you know, me and him travel together, so we're doing 10 days in like high school gyms all over the southeast part of America constantly. So there were just nonstop shows. I can't see there being that many of those being recorded,
but. You know, you talked about the wrist lock stuff. You talked about, and someone we haven't talked about a lot, really at all yet, and someone that I'm sure you have a lot to say on, is your first pay-per-view defense at Halloween Havoc against Davey Boy Smith, the British Bulldog himself. And, you know, those clips make the rounds sometimes on Twitter, just little clips of you, mostly the wrist stuff, mostly, you know, a lot of the wrist lock stuff. That must have been a thrill for you to wrestle a fellow countryman, you know, Calgary, but at the same time, he's from where you're from in a lot of ways. What was your relationship?
I was in awe of him because of how he'd made it. You know, like when I first started, Dynamite Kid and Davey Boy Smith had made it. If you're same as me, if you're a working class English kid and you make it, you get in, not only get into the wrestling and don't forget, I was watching them as a child. I think Dynamite was 10 years older than me. I'm not sure how many. Davey Boy, maybe 8.
And I don't think people understand how revolutionary, how exciting, how explosive the British Bulldogs were when they broke especially American television.
But I was getting to watch them when they were, I think Davey was 15 the first time he was on TV. And then I got to see him in my local wrestling hall live. And same with Dynamite. Dynamite was 16, I believe. And I think I was 9 or 10 when he was first on. And it blew my mind. I was like, I never got anywhere close to being the ability that they had. You know, I just, and that's actually, you talked about the match with me and Davey Boy. That's the reverse of that, of what I talked about before. That's just me holding his wrist and him doing all this incredible stuff. I couldn't do any of that. I couldn't do any of those head springs and all that stuff. But it's just me and him doing a British, more British style that became more prevalent in the 2000s with the Ring of Honor crew and all the young, because of the tape trade, as we've talked about that before, getting some, a lot like the Johnny Saint matches and different stuff. And there's a Steve Gray and Clive Myers, Iron Fist Clive Myers match was doing the rounds, and a lot of the fellas. And then fortunately, Brian Danielson coming into my life in 2000 and him taking more of an interest in that European stuff. And it all sort of spread, and it, you know, like then there was the mixture with all the 2000 lads and ladies that were trying to make a world for themselves because they didn't think they could get to WWE, you know, because they weren't, you know, 6 foot odd and whatever else. So they, if you, then you'll notice there's a lot more of the wrist stuff and that, but there was nobody doing that apart from, there would have been me, Davey Boy, Chris Benoit, and Scorpio would have been doing that in 93. And then it went, we all went our own ways. And then at the end of 95, Dean, Eddie, Chris came back in the November to WCW. And then it became quite normal to see that kind of stuff again. But there was a while where, you know, because they, at the beginning, Scorp and Davey Boy, both all Davey Boy, Chris, and Scorpio weren't around much longer in 93. They all went their own, went the different ways. So there was only me doing it for the next, a few years. That was me that was doing that style and keeping all that kind of stuff going with the people I could do it with, or however I figured it out. And then with you know, Dean, if you ever watched, Dean is very, very much European style stuff, mm-hmm. because of the Carl Gotch influence, and you know, he didn't, I don't know why he didn't spend, I know he came to Germany and did matches, I don't know why he didn't spend a lot more time in Europe, because when you watch him, it's like watching a European wrestler. But then he all eyes were on, and once you've got those guys doing that stuff, and everybody by that, there was that group of fellas that things started molding together, and then with ECW being around, and now them fellas like Eddie and Eddie wrestled at like a lot more European style. He didn't do the wrist lock stuff the same. He did do some of that, but if you watch him, you know, he was doing that. There was that, is that like hybrid. He was doing his lucha style and whatever, but he never worked that much in America, but he's uppercuts and different things that are very, he picked up in, I don't know where, but there was a connection between Calgary, Japan and Europe. Somehow there was a group of young wrestlers that all sort of, and I was more traditional British style because I couldn't do the stuff that they could do, the flying stuff. But that group of us were all sort of.
A lot of it probably came from, you know, Sayama and Dynamite Kid getting together many years before.
Then,
that's where all those cultures really
kind of
slammed together, you know, maybe the first time with you and Davey Boy. Of course, we would like to imagine, you know, that you know, this is a guy that you probably looked up to, that you saw wrestling when you were younger. Yeah. What was it like for you when he came in, and what was your relationship like?
Well, we came in together, and so I get the call to come to America, right? And then right as I'm coming in, I hear about the fact that Davey Boy's coming to WCW as well. So I come in, and we got on, like, House on Fire straight away. But he's, you know, he's a big deal there. I'm just me when I get there, and eventually do the Lord thing. And then, you know, and I think I'm staying around for a bit anyway. Because I didn't think, once I came here, my stuff wasn't working on TV. It was on live events because I had time, and I was wrestling Chris a lot. So,
right. But Davey was already a big star.
Davey was a huge star. So
that was a big acquisition, because he'd come off his singles run in WWE at the time.
Yes, huge. And just the year before, had sold out Wembley.
Wembley.
Right.
As the headliner, right?
I mean, not Wembley Arena, Wembley Stadium.
Right.
Which is like, you know, so Davey, you couldn't move in Britain without hearing about the British Bulldog. Unfortunately, it was the British Bulldogs. Dynamite had got hurt. But in 92, see, I was away for most of the year. We've talked about that before. I was away for 9 months of 1992. I flew back. There was a 1 week break at the end of August. I was in Vienna for 7 weeks which again, incredible. It was in the most beautiful city in Europe for 7 weeks in the same building every day. in an outside tennis.
That's the best part about doing a podcast with you is once in a while you'll talk about something and you'll just stop and you'll be like, my God, that was awesome.
We used
that
to
was
do,
so great.
I mean, those, we've talked about the German tournaments, but it was the 7 weeks of the summer was in Vienna, right in the city center of Vienna, in a outside tennis stadium. And next door was this 1,000-year-old building where the Vienna Boys Choir practiced.
Wow.
We'd get there at 6 o'clock at night, and you could hear them singing coming out of there. And then we'd wrestle there. Well, we finished there, and Rip Rogers was with us that year, 92. We had a week off, so we went back to England. He just turned up the other day. There was a bill on something showed up the other day, because I look at those old English bills, and there's I think we did three shows that week in England. We stayed in my house in Blackpool, but there was a week off in between finishing Vienna and starting Hanover for 9 weeks. Hanover in Germany with 9 weeks in the same place, but we had a week off, so we went back to England and we did three shows. So Rip got to wrestle in Britain, but and then we went back. Well, the day that we landed in England, we landed in London. All I could hear, the same day, we get there and I'm seeing all I think I've got this right. There was another short period of time when I flew in, whenever that show was, I had to go home anyway for something. I was in England. WWE fellas were at the same airport, and I didn't want to go up to them and say, you know, I'm a wrestler or anything.
Right,
but I flew in that day because they were all getting there ready for SummerSlam, whenever that was. So I don't know how that worked. I think it was that week with me and Rip.
Wow, that's something else, huh? That's crazy.
And so Davey Boy had sold out Wembley. So I go back to finish off my year in Germany, which was the 9 weeks in Hanover, a week off. No, that was the week. I went home at the end of August. That was when SummerSlam was. Rip didn't come then. I went home for a week. I went back and did 9 weeks in Hanover. Then I came back for a week before we started 5 weeks in Bremen. That is the week that Rip came with me. I came home after Vienna for a week so I could see my family. I didn't wrestle that week. I went home to see my family. And the day I landed was when the WWE people were coming in and I saw them and they saw Wembley. So when Davey Boy was arriving in WCW, I'm like, wow, great. I mean, and we got on like an house on fire because we knew all the same people and we trained together. There used to be Evander Holyfield had a gym by Atlanta Airport, a Gold's Gym. And we all stayed at a hotel by the, I think Davey was living in Tampa at the time. We all used to stay at this hotel when I first came here, right by the airport, the Ramada Hotel in Atlanta. And we used to go to the gym together, which was Evander Holyfield's gym. Or at least I think I don't know if he owned it, but he was always in there.
Davey must have been something else in that gym.
Yeah. And see, you know, I was never... I think we've mentioned this once. I was always a conditioning person. I did weight train, but when I was 22, my diving days ended. I did a dive once over the top rope and I ripped my shoulder out of the socket. So I went to a strictly ground game from then onwards. If you ever wonder where my style's... If I could have kept diving, I'd have probably ended up with a lot shorter career and a lot more injuries. But by the time I got to America at 24, I'd learned that I was a strictly ground game person only. So, you know, you go back and think, oh, he's a bit of an old fashioned style. It was through necessity to stay in the wrestling business.
Safety first, yeah.
And I'd learned that I couldn't do that.
Right.
Then I broke my neck and it just goes on and on. This shoulder was never right after when I was 22. It was never quite right. But I remember doing bench. We were in the gym in Atlanta. I remember David doing some ridiculous bench presses and I could just about struggle two plates out. But it's because this shoulder used to just like no strength in it.
Right.
After that is when I broke my neck, which even added more to this because there was nerve damage in it. So I used to just do like sort of lightweight training, but always did me Hindu push-ups and squats and whatever else right. and the wheel and stuff. I was always about conditioning.
And
about
Davies,
go. So we had that match. That, just while I'm on this train of thought, we had this match and it was very different. I know my friend Rob Naylor said it was like one of the big eye-opening things for him because he'd never really seen that style at the time.
I saw him say that,
Yeah. There was one thing that went wrong in that match, and I wouldn't say went wrong, but it's not right. And that was, I'm not going to say why, but there's one thing that I wasn't happy with in that match. And there's quite a bit, it's better on GIFs than it is to actually watch it, in my opinion. There was one thing went wrong, and then there was another thing that happened to Davy Boy that I had to hold him on the ground a lot for a while. And I don't want to say too much, but you'll see there's one thing where he goes to give me a reverse monkey flip off the ropes, and there was something went wrong in his leg, and he only went halfway with me, and I couldn't. When you do that, you have to actually catapult somebody like that.
Sure.
And his leg sort of went, it cramped up as we went up in the air like that, and so he sort of stopped. His leg stopped there, and I sort of tried to push myself off, and I sort of land on the back of my shoulder, but then I had to sort of hold him down while he got the movement back in his leg, and I'm not sure exactly what that was all about, but so until he got like he was going okay. So there's a point in that match where we have to sort of stay down on the floor for quite a while for him to get some feeling back. I don't think I've even told Harry that story, but that and now I'm thinking about it. There was a bit where he went, and you can see because he just stopped, his leg stopped off where there was something, it was either his hip or his leg, but he was just saying, just stay here a sec. And he there was something with his leg. We had to sort of get through it anyway. But then once he got the feeling back, we carried on with the end of the match because we hadn't talked about anything. We just we were just doing stuff and out there.
It went to a 15-minute draw.
Yeah.
Your next big match. Of course, you wrestled every TV. You wrestled every house show. We have what they called at the times, and Tony Khan is kind of bringing this thing back with the Battle of the Belts thing. Is a Clash of the Champions. You were Clash of the Champions 25, and you didn't do a draw this time, unlike a lot of the matches. This one was you defeated Johnny B. Badd, and of course we all know Johnny B. Badd. Mark Marrows had one of the best post wrestling careers of that you can imagine of people. He's an inspirational speaker now.
Yep.
At the time,
lovely
Dusty saw him and said,
fella,
I want you to be Little Richard. And so he had this Little Richard thing, but he worked it. Like, it worked. What was it like working with a young Mark Marrow / Johnny B. Badd?
I always liked him, and I got on with him, and because it was a different day and age, and if you came from when I came in the job, older wrestler or villain led the match. And so I just led the match. And so I thought we had some, for his skill level at the time, I thought we had some good matches. We were always good opponents.
You wrestled each other a bit.
We wrestled each other.
He was
a lot.
In that group,
and he was still he was trying to learn. You know, he hadn't been wrestling long, and he was thrown right in the deep end. Mm-hmm. I can say this: if you see who he's on with, though, he's on with Arns, Steve Austin's, Bobby Eaton's,
Ricky Steamboat, right? Yeah,
people that could help him through a match, and. That's no knock on him in any way, but I'm sure he knows that now. I don't know how he felt at the time, if he thought it, but there's a reason the people he was put on with, it was because we could help him through and know how to make the most of him and make him look as good as he looked. I hope he doesn't take that as a knock in any way, but he needed guidance when he was in there.
He's pretty honest and self-deprecating when it comes to his wrestling career. You know, he's very good at he talks to kids a lot. Inspiring speaker. Go ahead and look him up. Look up what Mark Mero's doing. Speaking of,
I liked him a lot. In fact,
as a person, right? Yeah,
he lived above me in an apartment. We lived in the same apartments. This infamous Le Parc Apartments, next to Sting and Lex Luger's gym. We actually got on really well. I remember the day he came down to my room when he first signed with WWE and told me he got a contract and how much money it was. It was because he was the first person to ever get a guaranteed contract from WWE.
Oh, well, that's your first mistake, right? You shouldn't be telling people.
No, but I think he just confided in, you know, he told me that. But I was happy for him because I liked him, you know. Like we had one little incident once, and that was with the Mr. Inoki thing. There was just a little, and he probably don't even remember it. It was like a little thing, but it was just me knowing that I don't think he realized how serious and who Mr. Inoki was. And I'd asked him not to shoot the gun thing off.
Right, the confetti cannon, right.
And the first thing he did was shoot it off all over the ring, and I was covered in these big silver things, and knowing that I had to do this thing with Mr. Inoki afterwards. And it wasn't anything. That was the slightest thing that we ever had a bit of. I might have said something to him afterwards, and nothing of any consequence.
Well, but we got on very well.
And we used to go to the power plant together, and I used to like wrestling him because he would listen, and people loved him. And so when you're a villain and you've got it, it doesn't matter anybody's whatever the person was. If you've got a baby face that people love, and you're comfortable as a villain, and you can go like that, and they'll go like that back, and you can go, ooh. You're off there to the races.
There it is.
That's all this job's about, really. And we make it complicated. So it was great when I wrestled it. We always had good matches.
And it's a lesson, I guess, about character too. He was all in on the character.
And
when you're all in on a character, it makes it easy to work. Easier to work, I'm guessing.
Yes.
With that character coming up. After this, you participated in Starrcade as TV champion in what is known as the Lethal Lottery, the Battle Bowl, and which is, you know, the randomized tag teams. And do you remember much of this? It was you tagging with Ricky Steamboat against Paul Orndorff and the Shockmaster.
Okay, so now I can tell this is a story. So Dusty was incredible to me. He loved Lord Steven Regal, right? And we, you know, Dusty was absolutely wonderful. Always, me and him got on. You know, I've told the story from day one. I've known him from day one that I turned up at TV in America, and we became very close. And especially the last few years of his life, we became very, very close. And I just a joke with him at that time, for whatever, like, because I. If you go back and look, I beat everybody at that time. I was the, you know, like, because I was whatever I was, right? I was the TV champion. I was beating it, all these people, or doing draws with them anyway. I was getting really, really looked after. But he had this thing that he was trying to help Fred out, Shockmaster, because it obviously hadn't played out the way they wanted to. They tried to make the most of it. And I obviously couldn't beat me in a singles match. If I remember rightly, this is where he gets to beat me, right? Is that the outcome of this match?
I think you lost the tag team match. You wrestled later that night against Ricky Steamboat, but in the tag team match, you lost the tag team match.
I lost this, and if I'm rightly, Fred beat me, right? Shockmaster beat me.
Yeah.
Dusty was set on getting Fred a win over me. And that was the way he did it, was in that match. That was just an odd pairing of a match. I should go back and watch that because I one of the few times I would have got to do anything with Paul Orndorff, and I'm such a huge Paul Orndorff fan as a wrestler, not and my friend as well. You know, like we at that time, me and him were, we used to hang out a lot, and just get, I got on with him so well. He was so helpful to me when I was younger. Like,
I was able to pass on those well wishes to Travis, his son, and he passed them back to you and said how much his dad thought of you as well.
Yeah, we got on really, really, really well. And that would be the only time I think that I did anything, actually got to do anything wrestling wise with him. I'm not sure if we even touched in that match. Because, you know, there's that many matches and
it's set up with a lot of, you know, people that don't want to lock up, you know, because it's a randomized tag team situation.
Yeah.
Hey guys, listen up. I know these days when you watch the news, it feels like it's one hit after another and it's all bad news for the economy. Well, let me give you some good news. It's not all that bad when it comes to real estate. Let me explain. You see, a year ago, man, real estate was hot, hot, hot. Everybody and their brother was trying to go out and buy another house. What did that mean? It was so competitive that a lot of folks got discouraged. So let me ask you, have you thought about buying a house in the last couple of years, but maybe just couldn't win a bid? I used to hear that all the time. Well, now is the time to buy. Yes, interest rates have creeped up a little bit, but what that's created is an opportunity for you. A year ago, it wasn't uncommon for there to be more than a dozen offers on a home, many of which were over list. That is not the case today. So if you got discouraged once before about trying to buy a new house, now's the time to take another look. Now, yes, interest rates have creeped up a little bit, but you're not going to overpay for the home. But here's what you will do. You'll stop throwing your money away on rent, and now you'll get a greater tax deduction. That's right. You see, at the end of the year, you're going to get a statement from your mortgage company that shows how much interest you paid, and you get to write all of that interest off. That means you could get a huge tax deduction. You never get that as a renter. Not only that, homes are still going up in value. Don't believe the hype. All of the economists believe long-term real estate always works out. Let me give you an example. Maybe way back when, in the housing collapse of 2008, you bought in 2007 and maybe overpaid. Buddy, if you hung in there, that house is worth a whole heck of a lot more now. If you've played in the stock market, you know what I'm talking about. You only lose money when you throw in the towel. Real estate long-term always performs well. So here's my advice to you. Date the rate, marry the house. Find the house that you and your family love long-term, because here's what's not long-term, these higher rates. I've yet to see a single economist who doesn't agree with me that rates are going to return. So doesn't it make sense to get the house you want right now? And then when rates improve, man, just get a lower monthly payment. In the meantime, you'll enjoy a greater tax deduction, and that property is going to continue to appreciate, meaning you're building equity and wealth for yourself. Not only that, how about this? We're going to save you some cash at buywithconrad.com. We're going to give you the peace of mind of a 7-year guarantee. When rates improve over the next 7 years, not if, but when, that's my prediction, we'll refinance you again with no new origination points. Think about that. That could save you thousands of dollars and give you the peace of mind of knowing that you got the right house for your family right now. And then when the rates improve, man, get a lower monthly payment. Now, you don't need perfect credit or money out of your pocket to do this, but you do need to hurry to buywithconrad.com. That's the first step. You tell us how much you want to put down and what you want your monthly payment to be. We get you approved, and then you go shopping just like a cash buyer at buywithconrad.com. NMLS number 65084, Equal Housing Lender. Seriously, if you've thought about buying a house over the last couple of years, but you got discouraged, now's the time to take another look. Let me run the numbers for you right now. You'll be glad you did at buywithconrad.com.
And you also wrestled Ricky Steamboat again and defeated him in that Starrcade. And of course, as this shows, by the time you hear this, it's still coming up the last weekend in November, Thanksgiving weekend. I believe Ricky Steamboat's having his last match in Raleigh, North Carolina. Y'all can look it up if you want to go. I might be going. I'll be in Winston-Salem that weekend, so I might go to Raleigh. But you end up starting 1994 with Dustin Rhodes, the young Dustin Rhodes. Man, what? When you talk about the word blue chipper, they used a lot about him. But yeah, he certainly was. He was like a puppy with big paws. Like, he had everything you knew he was going to be, like one of the greatest wrestlers in the world.
And we had I first met him in 1991 when I've told that story before, but I ended up working with WCW in England for 5 days. and we got on great. And so I wrestled him a lot once I became Lord Stephen. I wrestled him quite a bit on a lot of live events. In fact, the infamous tour when the night that the Sid and Arn Anderson thing happened, and yeah. I wasn't there because I'd gone home to Blackpool. We were 20 miles away the next night in Blackburn, and I turn up there, and then I find out about the Sid and Arn incident that had happened that night, early hours of that morning. I wrestled Dustin that night. It's funny things that jog your memory, but I wrestled Dustin in Blackburn that night.
Sure.
Robbie Rookside was there. Just things that has come into... It's
funny, good. The things in memory are either the things that are really good or really bad. Yeah. They're the things that kind of stick out, you know?
And me and Dustin always went out there, and right until my last days in as a wrestler in WWE, we'd done some very memorable things together. My favorite thing I ever did in WWE, as far as entertainment, was the Las Vegas showgirls.
The dressing
thing.
Yeah.
And that, I absolutely got to do two things like that with Dustin. One was where we dressed up as each other, but the showgirl thing was my favorite, because if you're a study British comedy the way that I have, old British comedy, I do little bits as tributes to all the people that have had an influence of me all the way down the ramp as I'm doing my little things. And then little bits, even in the match at the end of it, there's a little bit of, I'm not going to say who, but if you know what you're looking at, there's little tributes to all. Because once I got told that, I was like, people were like, you sure you're going to? I thrive on that stuff. I thrive on doing comedy. And I thought, what a perfect way to finally, whether you know it, if you know what you're looking at, there's all these little bits, Tommy Cooper and Larry Grayson and Hilda Baker and little peep things that I've sort of studied, these British comedians and there's little bits of it anyway in that particular thing. But Dustin, me and him always hit it off. One of my favorite ever moments in wrestling was against Dustin in Nîmes in France. For WWE on a tour, and it is a Roman Colosseum that was built by, it's in southern France, and it's where denim comes from. From denim means from Nîmes.
Oh, wow.
And denim, so there's a Roman Colosseum there, and it is on, all obviously Colosseums were built for acoustic quality.
For sure.
And we were on first, and I grabbed hold of, this is not, I don't know, not too many years ago, 12, 13, whatever years ago. When I say that to a young person sounds a long time, you know, to our age, it's like nothing. And we were on this tour, and we locked up, and I grabbed his arm, and I just pushed him to the floor with his wrist, holding his, I'm stood up, and he's on his knees, and I've got him by the shoulder and the wrist, and the people are going insane just from the beginning, and the acoustics, it's like you can actually feel it, like,
right, all that sound bouncing off that rock is just,
and he tried to get up off the floor, like he wanted to start moving about, and I went, don't move, I said, stay there, it's never going to get any better than this.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because it was from the simplest of things to the simplest of things before. And the people were going insane, and you could actually feel the vibrations through to your bones. And I said, it's never going to get any better than this. And just like, take a look around. And he looked around and I looked around, and you like, okay, now start coming up. And then we started going into the match. It was just like, I've never felt anything like it in my life. Any, because most of the stadiums you ever do, like the few times I did WrestleMania, I didn't like it. And there's people will tell you that you can't hear anything because they're so big, and the fans, that the actual stands are so far away. Like both times I did WrestleMania open matches, I come out thinking it was absolutely awful. And like quit. And actually a few times that I was going up and going, oh, I'm sorry. And they're going, why? I was going, because it was just nothing happening. You can't, when you're in the middle of the thing, you couldn't hear anybody. I don't know why, just the acoustics weren't right.
Right. And,
so I only ever did two of those really big stadium shows, but I couldn't hear anything. And it was just like really awkward. When you got no noise and nothing to work off as a wrestler, everything feels not right. It didn't to me anyway. Even
as a fan, outdoor arenas, I've been, you know, all the manias that my son and I have gone to, there's no comparison to being a building that has a roof that contains that sound, you know.
Well, let me tell you, the Romans had figured out better than anybody 2,000 years ago how to acoustically build a building.
Right.
For the major, so, and you know, you actually read about history, you'll learn a lot of that was a lot like pro wrestling, very much so. It was,
yeah,
it was,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of,
it would have to be because they would run out of workers in like
right, and it's all about putting a show on,
right, and
maximizing the effect of everything.
Well, of course, after beating Ricky Steamboat at Starrcade, we have another Clash of the Champions where you, as we talked about, faced Dustin Rhodes. You had Arn Anderson at Super Brawl. And then you did a series of matches.
Can I just say something about the Arn Anderson at Super Brawl? That's the one in 94, right?
Yes, February 94, yeah.
And that's the third. That's the 29-minute something.
Yes.
Right. So I will tell this story quickly. Arn is the person to ask about this because he tells this his way and I tell it mine, but it's both the same stories. Arn, at the time, didn't expect to... He thought, oh, it's just because I was on a big role. He was expecting 8 to 12-minute match. He went out the night before and...
No, that's impossible.
And it's a wonder I wasn't, but I wouldn't. At that time, I wasn't going out. I was strictly serious. It wasn't until a year later when I started going out with him. So that's when
that life's not for everybody.
Yeah. But at the time, this is 94 and I didn't drink and I wasn't doing anything. But anyway, I wasn't going out because I knew, you know, I was always ready to go. Well, Arn goes out and he gets in at very late hours or early hours of the morning. Well into Sunday morning. And he turns up and the actual match is basically a 30-minute draw. So he said, I'll be back later. And he disappears and goes to the gym to get a sweat on. And we have absolutely nothing. We've gone through this, but I think there's only me and Arn still care about this, but it's worth, you know, everybody else knows. He knew that we could go through 12, 15 minutes in a sleep. Me and him wrestled each other so many times we didn't even need to talk. But 30 minutes is 30 minutes. And so what he was like, okay, when he came back, what are we going to do? Well, we knew what he was doing at the very end. And so I said to him, let's just go out and register for each other. And I will never say that this match is a fantastic match. What I will say is if you are a young wrestler, if you want to learn detailed how to react and make every single thing you do mean something, watch this match and study it. Because we make the most out of every single thing to drag it out over 30 minutes. But every single thing is meant something. And it's that close up card magic stuff. The slightest of just everything is, there's nothing.
No holes.
There's no holes in it. It's all very credible. All and it might, again, it's a drawn out thing, and I'm not worried about, it was my job to do a certain, it wasn't my job to steal the show, it was my job to go out and do credible wrestling. Which is hard for people to know, but there's times when you used to get told that, go out and just, we want people focused in on this.
And to put in context, this match was longer than any other two matches combined, longer than the previous three matches combined.
Right.
This is an outlier in WCW at the time, and also an outlier on this card for sure.
But it isn't to steal the show, it's to go out and just have a credible match. And we go out there, and from the beginning to the end, if you want to really break it down and study the little nuances of how to get the most out of everything in this job, I don't like the word selling. I prefer, you all start off selling. When you learn to react, then your wrestling becomes better. This is a masterclass in reacting, this match. So that's what I'm going to say about this match. So
definitely check it out, guys. Super Bowl 4.
If you are a wrestler and you are wanting to learn how to, the nuances of how to react in wrestling.
But
yes.
Fans like stuff like that too. Like, that interests me as a fan as well. You know, to see pro wrestling as a kid, as it draws you in, as this fascinating, you know, superhero show. But as you get older, you start learning things like this, and you go, how are these guys doing that? And when you see that you guys are reacting, you know, just watching you as Steamboat, you know, watching you react to stuff so quickly, there's a time where in your Steamboat match that I saw today where you went for a double leg or something. I don't think he knew it. He went for a kick, and in real time, he softened up that kick. And I was thinking, wow, like, these guys are reacting in real time, and not, you know, it's an amazing thing for us fans to see as well. So, of course, if you're trying to be a wrestler, but for you fans who want to really see what's going on, then think you know what's going on, watch that match at Super Brawl 4, 1994.
And always know that, which is very difficult for younger talent, but this is a good thing to know. We never laid anything of this out. We would just go out there with knowing what was happening at the end. And if I spent more than 3 minutes talking about any match over 30 minutes that I've ever done in my life,
you're not writing it out on yellow legal pads before.
No, and nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. It just wasn't the way that I was taught.
Right. People criticize matches for not doing that now, but I know what you're saying.
No, I don't. I don't. It's just different ways.
If it works, it works.
If it works, it works. You're not going to hear that from me. I'm not one of them old wrestlers. It's just, that's the way I was taught, and that's the people I was on with, that's the way they preferred to do it. And if you wrestle me, that was the way I did it. Because another thing, I couldn't remember it. If you studied, then, because I just wasn't the way I was taught. So and luckily, because I was usually the more experienced wrestler or the villain, I got to lead the tempo. So if there's, I've told you before, my career looks far better in GIFs when you just see that, because there's a lot of like pacing and I'm not making excuses, but also knowing that this isn't working right today. Oh, this isn't working right today. My knee's not got, so I can't go 100 mile an hour today, but I can still do my job and keep everybody happy and keep a job in wrestling. Right? It's not about being the best bout machine. It's not about being whatever. I never thought about that. It was being a pro and doing my job and having a career and keeping the people paying me happy. That's why how we started this. I've never ever read a critique of any of my matches, because that I just, what, okay, well, if you didn't like it, you didn't like it. I'm sorry, it's too late. I've done it now. What can I do?
Right.
That's my thing. It's no knock on it. It's just, that's just the way it is with me. I don't
want to improve. You're going to listen to the people that you listen to. You don't need to listen because you have access to the greatest people in the world. Right. Right. So you didn't get fired, because what happened is something I'm not aware of until this very moment, is there was a series it looks like about 2 weeks, called Battlestars 1994, which is in Germany. It was 2 weeks of wrestling in Germany. There's a day one, day two, day three. You had a bunch of matches. One of the matches is Ricky Steamboat and Sting versus you and Ric Flair. Yeah. You wrestled Max Payne. You tagged with Ron Simmons. You tagged with Flair again. You wrestled Flair, but you defended the TV title one time in this.
Mad, isn't it, when you say these names out and you go,
it's crazy, right?
Like, and I'm just 20 odd, and I think we said it on the last podcast. If you actually put the list of names up of people, there'd be nobody. And that's not me trying to say there'd be nobody ever has had the list because of so many countries. And before I came to America, that will have all the times that I was fortunate enough to be around, like the Attitude Era, and well, the end of it, and then into the list of names and high rank, like big star names that I've been fortunate enough to be in the ring with. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. How's that happened to me? How's that happened to a lad that used to want to just be a wrestler? And basically all I am is just I'm just a journeyman wrestler.
Right.
That's what I am. Right. And I'm nothing special, but I'm a good pro. I could do my job. But if you look at the list of the names of the people I've been on with and fortunate enough to be on with and been around, and it's unbelievable. You just said that Ron Simmons, I've wrestled Ron quite a few times before he went to the WWE. We always had good matches. You know, I remember wrestling Ron one night, and Harley Race was my manager for some reason,
right,
on a live event, because I think it should have been Big Bubba
or Vader or somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, and I ended up, and Ollie was my manager one night, and then Ollie was my manager against, I'm getting confused. It was because Vader was something wrong with him, and Harley was, there was another night on that, in that time period, Harley was my manager against, he was the Guardian Angel at the time, but
Big Boss Man, Bubba.
Big Boss Man.
Yeah.
You know, like, just things that, who else can say that? Who's my age and had all these incredible, and it's not about me, it's about, I'm a fan of wrestling. I was a fan when I was a kid. How did all this happen to me?
Yeah, and the list of people who wrestled Anoki and Cena is short.
Right. It's like a charm life. Just I've had nothing but a charmed existence out of this wonderful job.
Well, I think part of the charmed life is getting to know, you had one title defense, is getting to know this guy. This is someone we haven't talked about a lot, someone near and dear to my heart as an adult fan, and just someone I think the world of. You wrestled for the TV title, won Cactus Jack. Right. Tell us a little bit about...
Where was that? In Germany?
That was in Germany in the two-week...
All right.
And let's see if I can pronounce this name in Germany. It is... The venue is Stadthalle Rostock. In Mecklenburg-Vorpommern.
I don't have no idea what that one is, but yeah. I know it's a Stadthalle. Here's a quick one for you. I was there the night that his ear came off, and Gary Michael Capetta came walking in the dressing room with his ear in his hand, and I wished I could say I picked it up and sang into it. I wished I could, but Gary Michael Capetta came, it was in Germany, he came walking into the dressing room with a ashen face like that, and he had Cactus's ear in it, well, what bit of his ear he had in his hand, and I did go up and touch it. I did go up and I poked the bit of stuff on his ear, So I can say I did that. I didn't. I wished I could tell you that I could make a better story and say I picked it up and sang into it like Michael Madsen in Reservoir Dogs. But no. But I did touch the ear in Michael Capetta's hand. Yeah. So you've actually shot me. I didn't think I ever wrestled Cactus until I thought I only wrestled him in a singles match once, and that was in the Bahamas. I know I wrestled him in the Bahamas. In a outside foot, like might be a baseball stadium with about 50 people there, which was, you remember the story when we ended up flying back and we ended up on the beach, me, Austin, and me, Steve, and Cactus. Well, the night before we wrestled each other in the Bahamas. There was about 50 people in this stadium. There was nobody there. And then That went on for there. So okay. You're telling me something I completely forgot, that I wrestled Cactus Jack in Germany.
You wrestled him a couple times. On day one, you wrestled him in a non-title match. Day five, you wrestled him for the title. And on day nine, he lost his ear.
Right.
So that was the same tour.
Maybe it's the traumatic experience of everything was overshadowed by the fact that
that's your memory.
Ear came
off. Is the ear. Is touching the ear.
Because I can't remember this. I can't remember this. I remember being in Germany when his ear come off. I remember being on. I can't remember this superstar battle bowl double.
So
double,
are you,
whatever it is.
Are you trying to tell me that for some reason you remember touching Mick Foley's decapitated ear more than you remember wrestling Johnny B. Badd the same night?
Right, yeah. So, sorry to all those involved, but yeah. Well, you know, there's not many times you get to touch, like, your friend's ear I love Gary Michael Capetta, and it was just a mad scene, you know. Like, I'm just in the dressing room, and I go, "Oh, what's that?" And I'm poking his ear.
I love.
So I got to poke a ripped off ear.
Foley's best quote from it, I'll never forget it from his book. He's like, "As I struggled for the German word for formaldehyde."
Oh, that's another thing. Yeah. See, is a little tidbit for you. You might have read this. What I do remember is being on those tours and Cactus cutting promos in German because he speaks pretty fluent German, which was amazing for the audience. He studied at, you know, in college or whatever.
Okay.
He spoke German.
I remember
a lot better than me, and I used to work there all the time.
He felt it was a wasted opportunity for WCW not to utilize his German more on these tours and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I've actually seen him in the ring doing German promos. You know, I was in China when John Cena turned up. We were doing a tryout and did a 10-minute speech in Mandarin. Unbelievable, just unbelievable. And I'd watched. This is when, you know, I got talk about nobody can say a bad word about John Cena to me. I used to see him for quite a while because we was on so many shows together with cards I'm learning Mandarin. Well, but I used to see him with these cards. That's what it. As soon as he got to the building, he's signing 500 photographs, doing radio interviews over the phone, and learning, never not sat and watched every, this is for any young wrestler who's not watching matches, and never not watched every single match that was on from the beginning to the end, and in any spare time that he had, sat reading cards, learning Mandarin, and then I was there the day that he turned up. I mean, he's done a film. He went over there and done a film with Jackie Chan, right? But turned up and did a 10-minute speech in Mandarin, right? So that's off topic, but that's how much commitment if you want to be a top wrestler in this job.
And he carries that through the rest of his life. I don't know if you've seen the show Peacemaker. Did you see Peacemaker,
no.
His TV show?
No.
But my man played piano for real. On Peacemaker,
right. Of course he
played he played this beautiful version of Home Sweet Home by Motley Crue, and it was him playing. You know,
of course he would.
That's a great lesson for young wrestlers too. Is
right. That's,
you know,
that's what
that
you
Larry
need
Bird type work ethic, or any kind of great athlete, that work ethic. You know,
a different league of kind of everything. Just, anyway, but yeah, Cactus used to do at the end of when we were in Germany. He would always get on the mic and do a promo in German, which endeared him immensely to the crowd. So yeah, so I'd forgot. It's a shame that I forgot that I wrestled him on those tours, but I did get to poke his ear.
Well, that's something. You probably touched his ear after he did, you know, like you might have been one of the last people to actually touch Mick Foley's ear. Someone we don't talk a lot about, and we should, because I think this guy was ahead of his time. I don't know if we talked about him much at all. Alex Wright, you wrestled him WCW Saturday Night in a defense. He got some gold eventually. He was someone that may have been a few years ahead of his time, but he seemed to have all the tools. WCW seemed to like him. What was Alex young? And he was young. Yeah. What was Alex Wright like as a young wrestler?
Well, I knew his dad. His dad was a very famous European wrestler, Steve Wright. Steve Wright was I believe the first person to be taught by an old wrestler and incredible trainer called Ted Bettley. Ted Bettley went on to train Dynamite Kid, Davey Boy Smith, Johnny Smith.
That's right. I read about him in Dynamite's book. Yeah. Right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, Steve Wright was his original protege, as far as I know. But he was his, you know, everybody knew there was a big connection with Steve and Ted Bettley. So I knew Alex through that. Alex started, as far as I know, he'd only had a couple of matches. One against Finlay, one against PCO, Carl Ouellette, in Germany. He had a couple of matches in Germany in 92 when I was there. In 93, WCW, actually, I don't know if he knows this, it's not like... Germany had WCW TV on, and they wanted a German star. And they said to me, do you know anybody from Germany? And they mentioned one name and I went, all right. I said, well, but this fellow was in his 40s. And I didn't say anything, but he was also a bit hard work. I won't say he is because he's no longer with us, but he was a bit hard work.
Right.
There wasn't too many German wrestlers at the time.
But he was high maintenance, kind of?
He just hard work.
Okay.
And he was a huge, and I mean a huge, big German, and he was just a bit hard work. And I never said anything about him, but I knew the only person who'd end up wrestling him would be Muggins here. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because I knew him and I'd wrestled him before.
Right.
I knew that... he was in his 40s anyway, and I knew he wouldn't want to lose to anybody because it was just the way he was. And I knew that there'd be... So I didn't say anything, but I said, there's this young lad. He hasn't done a lot. He hasn't had many matches, but let's have a look at him. So when we're in Germany, Steve Wright and brings Alex along, and... Was it me that wrestled him? Or I forget. So whoever. Next thing, Ric Flair sees him. I could have all this a little bit jumbled up. Loves him. Alex is in America. And he's only had an handful of matches.
Right. And this is in April 21st of 1994.
Right.
You the German tour ended March 20th of 1994. So
right.
Not too much longer than that.
He's had a handful of matches. And he had some in 93 as well in the German tournaments. But, you know, like I was in America by then. In 92, he had a couple of matches. That was the beginning. He was like 18 or so. Well, forget all. He was only young. And one of them, I didn't wrestle him then because I was a babyface in Germany. But I know Fit wrestled him. I know Carl Ouellette, PCO, wrestled him. And then he had some matches in 93 I wasn't there for. Whenever this conversation came up with the German, it was the German actual TV people, and I was there. They asked me, they said, what about such and such? And I went, there is this other lad. That's all I said. I didn't block this fella in any way, but I just went, there's Steve Wright's lad who was born in Germany. He's not like Steve was born in England and moved to Germany and lived in Germany, still does.
And to your credit as a future scout, you know, Alex Wright, literally on paper, had everything he wanted. Everything. He had youth, he had size, he had athleticism, he was, you know, he had a good look, everything,
Everything, and you know, and his dad was unbelievable. If you've never seen his dad, watch, there's a Steve Wright against Tiger Mask. It's the only match that, if you watch any other Tiger Mask matches, original Tiger Mask, it's about Tiger Mask. When he's on with Steve was so good, he just out-wrestles him. Steve's an excellent wrestler. If you didn't take anything from Steve, you just didn't get it.
Right.
He would out-wrestle you. Steve could do this like he was the real deal. But if you didn't take, the first time I ever wrestled him in 1989 in Bremen, I came out the ring and Dave Taylor looked at me, he said, are you thirsty? And I said, what do you mean? He went, well, you never got a drink of water in there, did you? basically you didn't get anything. So you learn, I've got to take, and a lot of wrestlers were like that. Like Finlay was like, if you didn't, you give an opening, if you didn't do something, they just kept doing their stuff. And it was like, not trying to be, it was just the way it was. They weren't going to let.
There's no pauses in a real fight either. Yeah, right.
Well, Steve, if you watch the match, it's quite a infamous match if you study Tiger Mask career. But Steve got over like $1 million. But really, he should have been there to get Tiger Mask over. But it ended up being Steve. It was incredible. Just did all this fancy, brilliant wrestling. And Tiger Mask basically ends up just holding his wrist for the entire match. So it's an incredible match. But misconstrued. I said this about on Steve Austin's podcast years ago, and somebody misconstrued this because I said it. Oh yeah, it didn't get a drink of water in it, because that's the way. It's an old European pro thing about saying
he didn't get a break.
It ended up the Steve Wright match and not the Tiger Mask match. Because Steve just showed everybody how brilliant he was. And that's the way he wrestled. And Milly Zerno was the same. There's a lot of people like that with this, you know, them fellas from a different day and age. If you didn't take, they didn't give you. And that was it. And that was how I got brought up with a lot of the wrestlers I wrestled. Fit Finlay, we've talked about that. If you didn't take it, you didn't give it you. You just, you know, Marty Jones was who trained me. Like, you wouldn't. If you didn't take your stuff, they just made sure the match looked good and they looked good. And they made you look good, but it ended up more in their favour, if that makes any sense. So young Alex was there and I said, what about this lad? Because he's young and he's not going to be, you know, he's going to fit right in and he's good looking and whatever else. Because the other person I did mention was... a friend of mine, Franz Schumann, but Franz Schumann was Austrian, and they said, no, we want a German, because German, you know, as much as we want to think the world is, you know, the way it is, at the time, I don't know what it's like now, there was a bit of a strange thing with Germans and Austrians. They wanted a German and not an Austrian, playing a German. It was their call, because they had as you notice, there was a lot of German tours at that time.
And you've got Bischoff in now, who's trying to expand in the worldwide and trying to find people to represent in different areas. And he knows, he's smart enough to know, if you pass off an Austrian as a German, that's not going to work so great for the German audience.
Yeah. I can also tell you another story about that. Alex wasn't, because of his style, he wasn't fitting in very well. And we were in Chicago one night. It might still be in the Allstate. I don't know if it's even called that now, but you know, the Allstate Arena. And I watched Eric was stood, and I was stood on the balcony watching him, and he was a bit down on it because he wasn't fitting in very well. Because his style was different, and he was young, and he didn't. We got to TV to the next, because Ric Flair saw the potential and loved him. This is absolute truth. Ric Flair was the booker at the time. Rick loved him, saw the potential in him, knew the young ladies were, you know, looked at him like that, as a baby face. When we got to TV, I asked Eric, can I have a dark match with Alex, please? Because Eric was, he might remember this different. I remember this crystal. Because it was Alex, you know, and I obviously, because his dad, you know, was a big thing to me, and his dad was very helpful to me, and I learned a lot wrestling his dad. I said, can I have a dark match? And I had a dark match at Center Stage with Alex. Well, I knew obviously he's a European wrestler. I knew all of Alex's dad's stuff. And I knew Alex knew all of Alex's dad's stuff, which is like, you don't see many Americans ever do the flying ankle scissors. Have you ever seen that one? It's like you ankle scissor somebody and all that.
Definitely,
right?
Yeah.
So I went out there with Alex and did all of his dad's stuff. Basically, Alex just did his dad's stuff. And we came, as soon as we walked through the curtain, Eric Bischoff thought Alex was the greatest thing in the world. So I kept, and I'm not trying to put anything on Alex. Eric wasn't very high on an Alex at the time. I asked for a dark match with him at center stage. He might not remember this, but it's the truth. And I put Alex, I flew all over for Alex and did all this stuff, and we and made him, and that was it. And that's what kept Alex in America, because right. Eric had told me he was ready for getting rid of him.
Showed Eric a different side of him, showed yes. him what he could do. Of course, you had a few other matches in 94. We're probably going to talk about when we talk about your second reign as WCW TV champion. We're going to finish
off. We'll have to, because it's going to be Christmas soon, isn't it?
Yeah. So we're going to close out just by talking about Fall Brawl 94, a year to the, not to the day, but to the event of Fall Brawl 94, you lose the title to someone we talked about earlier. You talked about earlier how some, usually it was the workers' title, but sometimes they would use the title to kind of elevate some people.
Yes.
And
yes.
And that's, I think, what the purpose was here, to give some credibility to young Johnny B. Badd.
Yep.
What are your memories about? I know it probably didn't bother you to lose the title, but you remember being told, okay, it's time to drop it, or what you're doing next? Or
This is where the one time that me and Mark had a little incident. So the night that I did the angle with Mr. Inoki should have been the night that Mark should have won the TV championship. A week or so before, we were at the CNN Center doing promos, as we used to do a lot of on a Wednesday. Mark came and asked me for the TV championship because he was on this thing that I did with Mr. Inoki.
Right.
There's only people that knew about it were the Japanese side, Eric and me. Right?
Sure.
So, Mark, and I said, I'm sorry, I said, oh, can I ask why? And he said, yeah, because I'm getting the championship at this next, I forget what it was, what we did, the thing with, the angle with Mr., when Mr. Inoki came into the ring when they were honoring him, before the match I had. And I said, I'm sorry, you can't. I said, and then Ric Flair was there, and he was the booker, and he said, well, I said, you better go and talk to Eric. I'm not going to tell, I'm not going to say anything. I've been told to keep this quiet. He went away. Rick went, whether he called him or went over, he used to have to go across the CNN Center and up into a different tower to WCW. I don't know what happened, but he came back and said, oh no. And we've gone into that on a different podcast, where the part of the deal with Mr. Inoki was he wanted to wrestle and beat in a non-title match to do right. this deal. But he'd also pick me because he wanted to beat somebody of the mythical Lancashire style. Well, Mark wasn't too happy about that. And so when we had this match on the night, and I told him not to shoot something, there was a few words said afterwards. Then I go off to I do the match with Mr. Inoki.
Right.
I
because after losing the title, that's right. when you head off. Right.
Right.
I
do the match with Mr. Inoki. I'm still the TV champion. And then the following thing, whenever it is, that's when I drop the TV championship to Mark. But Mark was told that he was going to get it on the night that I did the actual angle in the ring with Mr. Inoki when he was sat on the front row. So that's a story that nobody has ever heard before or knows. Mark should have got that championship on that night that I did the thing with Mr. Inoki, but I knew I couldn't because of the match I had to have with Mr. Inoki. And then the following time, that's when Mark, so whatever it is you're telling me, you'll find that is after I did the match with Mr. Anoki.
Well, that brings us to the close of this episode, and that's a great story to close it up with. Of course, we kind of glossed over a couple things we're going to talk about next time we talk about the TV Championship. Matches with Brian Pillman, matches with Larry Zbysko, and you're going to have to wait for that because we're going to do it next time we talk about the TV title, which will be not too long in the future. Next time you see us or you hear us on the Gentleman Villain Podcast with Mr. Regal.
Thank you very much, Philly. Listen, thank you.
Woo Wings, a virtual restaurant concept from the man himself, the nature boy, Ric Flair. Enjoy the legendary flavors and world championship wings by ordering with your Uber Eats or Postmates app. Woo Wings is now open in Nashville, San Antonio, Jacksonville, Florida, as well as Huntsville and Tuscaloosa in Alabama, with many more locations coming soon. Try the only chicken wings worthy of carrying the name of the 16-time World Heavyweight Champion. Tell them, Nach.
Wings! Legendary flavors! World Championship wings! Woo! Woo Wings! Yeah! Woo-woo!